Well, tonight the closing ceremony of the Paralympics will take place, and after that, of course, our attention moves off the Olympics and focuses again on the Winter Olympics. And perhaps the greatest Winter Olympic film ever made was Cool Runnings. I'm going somewhere with this. So you may have seen the film Cool Runnings. It's about the Jamaican bobsleigh team. And there's a great scene in it where one of the team members has been in the bar, and he's basically being bullied by one of the East German team. And the East Germans are the baddies. Perhaps you could have guessed that. This Jamaican's being bullied, and he's just very timid and takes it. Well, one of his teammates sees what's going on and grabs him and marches him into the bathroom and stands him in front of the mirror and says, "Look in the mirror and tell me what you see. Tell me what you see." And this guy says, "I see Junior." That's his name, Junior. And the guy says, "Well, let me tell you what I see. I see pride." You all know it, don't you? "I see pride. I see power. I see a bad something, mother, who don't take no rubbish off nobody," or words to that effect. "I see pride. I see power." And he makes him repeat it. And then he goes out and they all have a big fight in the bar. The issue is one of perception. They're both looking in the mirror at the same thing, but what do you see? Tell me what you see. An issue of perception. We're going to look at this letter to the church in Philadelphia, and because it begins with P, not just because it begins with P, we've got four P's that are going to guide us through. And the first is perception, power, patient endurance, pillar. So, perception. I want you to imagine that it's Christchurch Derby being dragged into that bathroom and stood in front of the mirror. And as Christchurch Derby is there in front of the mirror, the question comes, what do you see? Tell me what you see. Now, you see, there might be plenty of things about the church that you are positive about. So you've been going a couple of years and you see plenty of positives, plenty of growth. You've been having great teaching from the Bible. Perhaps you've been learning lots of new things, making new friends, plenty of good things. But you see, it might also be the case that as you look at your own reflection and you think about the church, you think, well, actually, there's a few things that are unnerving. You might feel small. You might feel vulnerable. You might feel, as a church, irrelevant, insignificant, in the face of a city who frankly don't really care about Jesus. What about people around you, people at work, people at university? How do they view the church? Not just Christ Church, but how do they view the church in this country? Perhaps they see it as irrelevant, again, as something not to be too bothered about. UK attendance, church attendance, sorry, has about halved in the last 30 years. 30 years, church attendance has halved. And of course, the cultural influence of the church has declined drastically, as seen, as Mike was praying about, this case that's gone to the European court. Well, perhaps you're here today and you're not a Christian. You're perhaps just invited along by a friend, or you're visiting. Well, what is it that you make of the church? As you look on, and you look on at maybe Christchurch, if you know something about this church, or the church generally, what is it that you see? What do you make of it? You see, sometimes people complain the church is full of hypocrites. Sometimes people claim the church is dangerous. But I guess most people would say, to borrow a phrase from Douglas Adams, that the church is mostly harmless. Basically, we don't really care. And that may also describe the attitude of your friends and family members. Well, today, as we look at this letter in Revelation chapter 3, it's a letter from Jesus that he gives in a vision to a church in a place called Philadelphia. If you've been here previous weeks, you'll know you're working your way through these seven letters that Jesus gives to seven different churches. And you see, Jesus says to this church in verse 8, halfway through verse 8, he says, "I know that you have but little power. I know that you have but little power. And you see, I think that gives us an indication that the Philadelphian church felt pretty weak. They felt pretty small. They felt pretty insignificant. They perhaps felt vulnerable. From verse 9, it says, "I'll make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they're Jews but are not." That indicates that there's opposition from the Jews. Stiff and severe persecution, perhaps, they're going through. They'll know of what's happened in Smyrna and these other letters, as we've read about the persecution that's been going on around. And Pergamum, where we read, you'll have seen a few weeks ago, Antipas even killed for his faith. They probably felt very small and very vulnerable. When Jesus says, "I know that you have but little power," saying that I know how you're feeling. I know that you are small. Maybe that's small in numbers. Maybe it's small in cultural significance. I know that you feel weak. I know that you have but little power. But Jesus is saying to the Philadelphian church, and I think he's saying to us, I want you to change your perception. You might look at yourself in the mirror and think weak, vulnerable, insignificant. But Jesus says, well, you may have but little power, but you have me. And that changes things greatly. These seven letters, again, as you've probably seen in previous weeks, there's seven is significant. Numbers are very significant in the book of Revelation. Seven sort of stands for completion or perfection. So by writing to seven churches, of course they are seven real churches, but it also indicates the idea that Jesus is writing to the whole church. And so lessons that we draw from each of these letters, we apply to ourselves, rightly so. And here Jesus is going to talk to the church in Philadelphia, but in so doing he will also be speaking to us. Perception. Tell me what you see. Our second P is power. In each of these little letters, Jesus describes himself, a little bit of self-description. And so we read in verse 7, the words of the Holy One, the True One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one will open. Oh, we've got a little box of keys. They're mostly Jenny's, my wife's, and they're in a little wooden box, and she's just gathered them through her life. Now, some of them are to bike locks, some of them are to padlocks, some of them are to houses, and frankly, she doesn't really know what most of them are for. She doesn't know where the bike locks that they relate to are, she doesn't know where the padlocks are, and yet we've got these keys. She doesn't want to throw them away because she says it just doesn't feel right to put a key in the bin. What if a burglar finds it? And somehow manages to work out which bike lock it relates to, goes back to Cambridge or wherever it was that she had that bike lock, and manages to unlock whatever it is now locking. A box of useless keys. Compare that with this key of David that Jesus says he's got. I've got the key of David. Well, it couldn't be more different. Our bunch of keys, a box of keys are useless. Jesus' key, well, it is the most powerful key. When he calls it the key of David, that's an Old Testament reference, which we won't look up, but if you're interested, you can read about it in Isaiah 22. But the point is this. This is a key that has all power. What it unlocks stays unlocked, and what it locks stays locked. The point is, if Jesus wants a door open, it will be open. If he wants it shut, it will be shut. Just another picture, another way of saying that Jesus has got tremendous power. It's a point that Revelation makes again and again. Jesus is powerful. And in all these different images and pictures of him, keeps coming back to this same point. Now, we sometimes use the word sovereignty, which means Jesus is in control of everything. That's what we see with these keys, or this key, sorry. A key that locks permanently and unlocks permanently. Jesus has power. But you see, not only does he have power, he uses his power on behalf of his people. Jesus uses his power on behalf of his people. So we read in verse 8, I know your works. Behold, I've set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. He's just told us he's got this key that's got this amazing property of what it opens will stay open, what it shuts will stay shut. And now he says, and I have opened a door for you, and no one will be able to shut it. What does it mean when Jesus says, I've opened a door? Set before you an open door. Well, I think it's pretty similar to how we'd use the expression. You know, we'd talk about a window of opportunity, or, you know, testing different doors to see which way I should go with my life. Well, Jesus is saying, look, I've set before you an open door, a door of opportunity. Here it is. I've ordered your circumstances. I've put you where I've put you, and the open door is there for you. And you know what? Because I've opened it, no one is going to shut it. No one's going to shut it, and it will stay open until I decide to shut it. So the opposition you're facing from the Jews, well, that can't shut the door. The opposition that you may face from the Roman authorities can't shut the door. Satan and all his demonic hordes can't shut the door. He's put before them this open door, and he says, look, now is your opportunity to use this door. We don't know the specifics of what he's meaning. But it seems that it's an opportunity for the gospel to go out. You Philadelphian Christians, the door is open. Use it. Go, preach the gospel, serve Christ. The door is open. I don't know, and you don't know, what Christ Church is going to face in the next 12 months. Whatever it is that you face, whatever it is you go through as a church, you need to remember that Jesus is the one who orders your circumstances. Jesus is the one who opens and shuts the doors. He's the one in absolute control. Philadelphia needed to know this because it certainly didn't look like Jesus was in control. They have but little power. They're a small, weak church, feeling insignificant under the threat of persecution. They need to know Jesus is still in control. And perhaps that's a lesson that we need to learn today as well. Jesus uses his power on behalf of his people. And he goes on to say, this all-powerful Jesus, that he will vindicate his people. Let's look again at this strange verse, verse 9. Behold, says Jesus, I'll make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie, behold, I'll make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. This phrase, synagogue of Satan, has already come up in chapter 2 in the church to Smyrna, so I'm sure it's been explained a few weeks ago. But the point is this, those Jews who have rejected Jesus as their Messiah are now being described in this strikingly harsh way. Synagogue of Satan. Well, because once you've rejected the Messiah, once you've rejected Jesus, come from God, well then you're no longer fit to be called a follower of God. And so therefore, he says, they say they're Jews and are not. He means they no longer have the right, the privilege to be called the people of God. But Jesus says, I'm going to make these who are opposing you, the synagogue of Satan, I'll make them come and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. He's saying to his church there under pressure in Philadelphia, they're going to see. Those who oppose you are going to see that I have loved you. They're going to come and they will have to admit it. Jesus always conquers. Jesus always conquers. He has the key of David. And he conquers in two ways. You know, Jesus conquers by either his just, right judgment that we deserve against all our sin, all our rejection, a rebellion against God. And he conquers with his judgment. Or, wonderfully, he conquers with his salvation. When he offers all of us the chance to come to him, to come to him now, to bow, to repent. And he conquers his enemies by turning them into friends. Ultimately, all those who oppose Jesus' church oppose Jesus himself. Now, that was the lesson that Saul learnt on the road to Damascus. If you remember that story, some of you might know it from Acts, where Saul is going along to persecute Christians, and a voice from heaven comes and says, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Saul says, "Well, who are you?" And the voice says, "I am Jesus, whom you're persecuting." When people oppose the church in Philadelphia, they're opposing the one who holds the key of David. When you as Christ Church face opposition and difficulties, when you as individual Christians face hardships and persecution and opposition, well, that opposition is ultimately directed against Jesus, the one who says, "What I open will stay open, what I shut will stay shut." Now, this might be something you've never thought about. If you're visiting, or you come along for the first time today, this could all be sounding very strange to you. This stuff about Jesus and judgment and bowing before him. I heard a quote the other day from a guy called Dr. Ben Goldacre. You might have seen him. He pops up on the TV from time to time. He's written some popular science books. But he said this, asked the question, "Do you believe in God?" He said, "I'm not even an atheist. I'm an app atheist. I just couldn't care less either way. It holds no interest to me at all. Every conversation I've ever had about it, just so dull." Do you believe in God? Well, I'm an app atheist. Couldn't care less either way. Would you see how stupid that sort of statement is? If God exists, then that has a tremendous relevance and significance to your life. You cannot afford to be app atheistic, because he says, "I have the key. And I will make those who oppose my church come and bow." Perhaps that's something that you need to think about today. If you've never bowed to King Jesus, then today would be a great time to do that. But Jesus will vindicate his people. He'll keep them from trial, he says in verse 10. "Because you've kept my word about patient endurance, I'll keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world." And the sense there is not that he's going to protect them and take them out of suffering, but rather he's going to sustain them and uphold them through their suffering, through whatever it is they face. Just as Jesus prayed for his followers in John 17, "I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but keep them from the evil one." There's no need for you as an individual Christian, you as Christ Church, to feel weak or insignificant in the face of opposition. Because you have Jesus with you, and Jesus will always conquer. He will always vindicate his people. The Scottish reformer John Knox had this great saying, "A man with God is always in the majority." A man with God is always in the majority. Another Scot, a lady called Mary Slessor, was a missionary who went out to Africa the second half of the 19th century. And in one of her journals, she scrawled down words to that effect. I think the way she worded it was, "With God, you're always in the majority." She went out and faced horrible tribal brutality, put herself in the way of danger to confront those who would beat and kill people without trial, those who would throw baby twins in the woods thinking that they were demonic, those who would strangle the wives of a man who had died as part of his funeral procession. And in the face of all that hostility, she knew that when she had God with her, well, she was in the majority. That is, she was okay. She was on the right side. Power. Great power. Our third P is patient endurance. If you have been here for the last few weeks, you'll know that these letters sort of follow a pattern. They normally have this description of Jesus at the beginning, and then some sort of commendation and some sort of rebuke. But when we read this one, we find that there is no rebuke. Again, in Smyrna, there was no rebuke for that church. But Jesus has nothing to rebuke, only things to commend. And what is it that he sees? What is it that he commends? What is it when he looks at this church that he thinks that is worthy? Well, it's not their numbers on a Sunday. It's not their great successes in evangelism. It's not the way they're really making an impact on the culture. What it is that Jesus commends is their patient endurance. Verse 8, again, he says, the second half of verse 8, you have but little power, yet you've kept my word and have not denied my name. Verse 10, because you've kept my word about patient endurance, I will keep you. Their great triumph, their great victory is just persevering, enduring, keeping going. Christian victory is not glamorous. You know, perhaps you fall into that trap sometimes of daydreaming about witty put-downs that you could give to the aggressive atheist. Or you've had a conversation and then you're replaying it again over and over in your head and you keep coming up with all these great incisive points you wish you'd said. And this person, this skeptic, would have immediately seen how wise and clever you were. Perhaps you long for the church just to be seen as something respectable and important. That might just be me. But the point is this, Christian victory is not glamorous. What does he say in verse 11? Hold fast to what you have. That's all you need to do. Just hold on to the gospel. Hold on to the good news of Jesus. But that is, of course, why it is also so hard. Because it's standing firm in the everyday, standing firm in the million and one opportunities we have to stand or fall, that is where it gets so hard. Because actually, I don't really want to put my head above the parapet. I don't want to put myself at risk if it's going to cause embarrassment or if it's going to cause hostility. I know I want to live for Jesus, and yet it's so easy to deny him, and so hard to hold fast, so hard to keep up that patient endurance when I feel like my life is just so difficult, when I feel that the opposition is not worth facing. And you see, when you feel so weak, when you feel like, I just can't do this, I can't hold on anymore, I can't stand, Jesus says, I know you have but little power. I know. But you also have me. I will keep you. Hold fast to what you have. And that's what you need to do as a church. Christ Church Derby. It's not looking for big, glamorous things. It's looking for the simple, everyday. What are you wanting to do? Hold fast to what you have. Keep going with the gospel. Keep the word. Keep Jesus' word, as he says. Don't deny him. And that will bring great commendation. Patient endurance, our last P is pillar. All these letters end with a great promise of the future. And the one we read here is in verse 12. Jesus says, the one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it. I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. And I don't think it's by chance that the church who feels like they have but little power, Jesus says, I'm going to make you a pillar. Because what do we know about a pillar? Well, it has to be firm, it has to be strong. And he says, I'm going to make you a pillar. A pillar, not just any old pillar, a pillar in the temple. Not just that, you're going to have the privilege of these names engraved upon you. The name of God, the name of his holy city, the New Jerusalem. Jesus' own new name. Now, what is that? What's he saying there? Well, I think what he's saying is this pillar, when I make you a pillar, I'm making you a pillar in the temple, it's a picture of that close and enduring communion with God, that relationship with God. Your perceived weakness turns into that strong pillar in the firmest building of all time. To a church that feels weak, Jesus reminds them of his great power. He commends them for their patient endurance. He urges them to continue to stand until they are made pillars. Hold fast, he says in verse 11, so that no one may seize your crown. Keep going. The end is in sight. And again, as he says in verse 11, I am coming soon. This powerful Jesus, who stands behind his church and watches over us, he's not distant. He is coming soon. Change your perception. You may feel weak, but he is strong. Just want to finish by turning to Luke chapter 12. I'll leave you with this verse. Luke chapter 12, 32. It's on page 1050. Page 1050, Luke chapter 12, verse 32. These are words of Jesus. And he says, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. See, Jesus knows that we are the little flock, the weak flock, vulnerable and insignificant. And yet he says, fear not, you have nothing to fear, because it's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. God has got something so wonderful in store for you. Fear not, but hold fast to what you have.